Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This morning, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, amid ongoing Russian attacks and bombings on his country, appealed directly to the world's largest democratic alliance.
Ми звертаємось до Європейського Союзу щодо невідкладного приєднання України за новою спеціальною процедурою.
We appeal to the European Union for immediate accession under a new special procedure, Zelensky said. Our goal is to be with all Europeans, and most importantly, to be equal. I am confident it is fair. I am confident we deserve it. I am confident it is possible, he said. Well, over the past 72 hours, the European Union itself has taken several major and virtually unprecedented steps for the alliance, acting forcefully against Russia in the financial sector, sending weapons to Ukraine, and several member states making commitments to significantly strengthen their own militaries. And yesterday, on a continent that has often opened and often closed the door on refugees, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen announced the EU's welcome of Ukrainians fleeing the attack on their nation.
President Zelensky's leadership and his bravery and the resilience of the Ukrainian people are outstanding and impressive. They are an inspiration for all of us. We welcome with open arms those Ukrainians who have to flee from Putin's bombs, and I'm proud of the warm welcome that Europeans have given them.
Well, the past 72 hours mark a watershed moment for the European Union. Is the world witnessing a rapid transformation of the EU? Has Ukraine's resistance to Russian aggression united the EU in ways that weren't fully conceivable just a week ago? And of course, Ukraine is not formally in the European Union. So what does this mean for Ukrainians themselves over the next 24 or even 48 hours? Well, let's start right in Ukraine. Olga Tokaryuk is a freelance journalist and non-resident fellow at the Center for European Analysis. She joins us from Western Ukraine. Olga, thank you for being with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Can you first describe what the last 24 or 48 hours have been personally have been like for you personally, Olga?
Yes. Here in the Western Ukraine, it's relatively calm, definitely compared to what is happening in in central and eastern part of the country, in Kyiv, in Kharkiv, also in southern Ukraine, that is a part of which is under control now of Russian occupying forces. There are heavy battles going on around Kyiv, also in Kharkiv. Kharkiv has been shelled earlier today by Russian artillery using cluster munitions, causing massive casualties, dozens of casualties. That was done deliberately during the talks between Russia and Ukraine. So Russia is escalating again. Well, you know, compared to that, it's relatively safe here. There was an air alert last night, and we had to go in the basement at about midnight local time. We spent about 1 hour in the bomb shelter before this air alert was lifted, and we were told that we can go back safely to sleep. And there is a curfew, but like, as I said, it's nothing in comparison to what is happening around Kyiv and Kharkiv.
Okay.
The main issue here is we are having a large influx of internally displaced people coming from those areas that are most affected by the fighting. And currently, in the house where I'm staying, we are housing, also we are hosting six other people who fled from Kyiv, and some more people are about to come today. And almost, I think, every family now in the Western Ukraine is sheltering someone because there is a massive influx, you know, of internally displaced people. And some of them also go further west and southwest towards the border between Ukraine and the EU countries such as Poland, Romania, Hungary, Slovakia. So a humanitarian exodus of big proportion.
Can you tell us more? First of all, let's talk about the two other cities that you mentioned, Kyiv, the capital, of course, and Kharkiv. First of all, with the capital, what do you know about what's happening there now, today?
Yes, well, Russian forces were trying to are trying to encircle Kyiv, to, you know, cut it out of the rest from the rest of the country, and basically to establish a siege over Kyiv. They were unable to enter the city or to, you know, take hold of the city. They, when they attempted to enter, they were very fast eliminated by the Ukrainian armed forces, by Ukrainian territorial defense, which is showing incredible, you know, heroism and determination, and is really achieving a lot of success on the ground fighting with Russian land forces. The biggest problem is air, you know. Ukraine has some air defense, and it's largely successful. Ukraine doesn't have missile defense. And according to Ukrainian government, Russia launched 160 Iskander missiles on the territory of Ukraine, and add to that other kinds of missiles that Russia has been launching, targeting military infrastructure, but not only targeting, on also civilian objects such as hospitals, kindergartens, ambulances, orphanages. So, you know, that's what makes life of civilians in the urban areas very dangerous. And we are seeing Russia is willing to step up with attacking civilian targets. And the events in Kharkiv today are a confirmation of that. I'm very worried for my friends who are still in Kyiv. A lot of them are, and a lot of them are people with children, you know. Who are either unable, or they were up until a certain point not willing to leave. I don't know, like, is that changing looking at what is happening in Kharkiv, because they were hopeful, you know, that somehow in Kyiv, okay, yes, there are air alerts, but they got used to that and they can somehow persevere and will not be forced to leave the city.
Yeah.
But leaving is difficult too. It's, you know, the logistics to leave the urban areas is not easy at the moment, because the roads, there are blocks on the roads, and the roads are also clogged by traffic. Not everybody owns a car,
right.
So it's difficult to leave. There were some evacuation trains added by the Ukrainian railways, but they are overcrowded. And on the train that our friends arrived a few days ago here, they were basically, people were standing, you know, they traveled for 17 hours on their feet, and they shared their compartment that is usually for four people with 12 adults, with 12 people, seven adults, five children, three cats, and a dog. So people are, you know, desperately trying to get out of the urban areas that are by the fighting, but it's not easy.
Yes, and you've reported that in Kharkiv, as you mentioned, there's shelling going on of hospitals, schools, etc., and Ukrainians are some of them trying to shelter in, as we've been seeing, in basements, and also in the metro. But it sounds as if there's an emerging humanitarian crisis there right now.
Yes, there are reports from Kharkiv that the food supplies are running out. There are problems with the drinking water. And actually, some of the people who died today as a result of this artillery strike by Russia were people who went out, you know, to get water. And there are these, like, really gory images of people and the bottles of water lying on the ground after this terrible strike. So, yes, the access to the problem is that Kharkiv is located 40 kilometers from the Russian border in eastern Ukraine. And basically, there are no other ways to access the city at the moment. There is it can be accessed by land, but since the fights are going on, it's not easy to get there. You know, like, other routes are difficult to get there.
Yes.
And obviously, there is no air traffic over Ukraine because, well, the fight is going on in the air. I don't know. I'm afraid, you know, that we might be facing a humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in the next days. And urgent measures should be taken by the International Red Cross or, you know, other humanitarian organizations to demand Russia to provide civilian population with to allow, you know, the passage of, like, food and medicines and water and all the basic necessities to the population in the urban areas.
Yes. And Olga, you mentioned very rightfully so, that this escalation that you're describing Russia undertaking in Kyiv and Kharkiv is going on today as there are talks happening in Belarus between Ukrainian and Russian officials. What more do you know about what's been going on in the talks thus far?
The talks were announced yesterday that there will be a delegation from Ukraine and a delegation from Russia. The delegation will not consist of the highest ranking officials. From Ukraine, the highest ranking official is the Minister of Defense, Oleksiy Reznikov. It's six people delegation. Ukraine said that the President Zelensky, he said that the expectations from these talks are pretty low, and it's not looking like Russia, you know, is willing to stop its war, stop its invasion and aggression of Ukraine. And the fact that they bombed Kharkiv during the talks is indicative of that. The Ukrainian presidential advisor said that, Ukraine's demand at these talks would be for Russia to withdraw all its troops from the Ukrainian territory, including the territory of occupied Donbass and Crimea that was seized illegally in 2014. So we still have to wait and see. There are no news at the moment about the outcome of these talks. There are photos of these talks going on. So it's very early to say something, but my expectations are pretty low. And the fact that Russia is escalating on the ground doesn't give much hope for optimism.
Olga, we just have 30 seconds before we have to take our first break here. Can you just quickly tell me, how have you been doing these many days?
Well, I'm very busy. As opposed to many Ukrainians who now lost ability to do their jobs, especially, in the areas affected by the fight. And that's also a problem because many enterprises have been forced to stop. They cannot function. They have been seized. Some of them, they were seized by Russian troops on the territories occupied in the southern Ukraine, for example, because there are some territories are currently under Russian control that are bordering Crimea and the regions bordering Crimea. The fear is that, some people might be also losing their livelihoods. For me personally, I have a lot of work to do, so it's not a problem.
Well, Olga, hang on here for just a moment because we do have to take this quick break. We'll want to hear much more from you when we come back. We're talking about Ukraine and the European Union's immediate future. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we're finding out the latest of what's been happening in Ukraine today as the country continues to resist Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And we're also looking more broadly about how Ukraine may have already transformed the European Union. I'm joined today by Olga Tokaryuk. She's a freelance correspondent and a fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. She joins us from Western Ukraine. Let's listen to a moment to how the European Commission itself describes some of the actions it took over the weekend, including two rounds of sanctions targeting Russia, Russian oligarchs, and Russian President Vladimir Putin himself. Here's EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen.
Under this package, important Russian banks will be excluded from the SWIFT system. We will also ban the transactions of Russia's central bank and freeze all its assets to prevent it from financing Putin's war. And we will target the assets of Russian oligarchs.
Well, joining us now from Brussels, Naomi O'Leary. She's Europe correspondent for The Irish Times. Naomi, welcome to On Point.
Hi, great to be with you.
How would you describe the unity with which the EU took several actions over the course of the weekend?
It's been a really momentous weekend, and there's been a striking transformation, I suppose, in the public policy of EU national governments. We're talking about 27 countries, and usually they have different viewpoints on things. But with the invasion of Ukraine, the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has achieved almost the opposite of what he wanted. He's not divided, but he's united the European Union. He's caused them to take steps that were once unthinkable. There's been an outpouring of solidarity for Ukraine. And, you know, the EU had been ready for this. They had some sanctions ready, but they were rapidly overtaken by events. The public horror at the invasion was such that national leaders began to come under really fierce pressure to do more, to isolate Russia more, and to help Ukraine more. And in response to that, over the weekend, we saw a series of really historic shifts in policy, from Germany announcing enormous arms investment to the EU paying for lethal military aid itself.
So let's talk about that a little bit more, because it seems as if, I mean, the European Union as a union had talked about for years taking on a more formal military role. They hadn't done much, as far as I can measure, until now. But as you noted, they're now providing EU-funded military equipment, including fighter jets, to Ukraine. How much of a difference is that from the EU that we knew even just 3 days ago?
It's astonishing. The agreement was reached incredibly quickly on Sunday. What it is there have been efforts for years, like you mentioned, for the EU to do more to cooperate on defense. All of its member states have some kind of national defense. And, you know, it's been argued for a very long time that if they work together, if they cooperate, they'll be one of the world's biggest military forces. But that cooperation has been very slow in coming. There's not much public appetite for military spending usually. And also the nervousness. I mean, you know, governments not so sure about whether it's a good idea to sort of club up on it. But the major step forward that we saw this weekend is, for the first time, a decision to jointly fund arms for a conflict. 450 million has been set aside for that. The agreement was reached incredibly quickly. It didn't have to be written anew. It was actually a program that had been designed and agreed last year. It's just that it had never been used for lethal aid before. So that was ready. Everyone came on board. There were three countries that traditionally have neutrality policies, and they were able to opt out of being involved, of their cash going to military aid. But they used what's called constructive abstention. So that means they don't mind other people going ahead and doing it. That was Ireland, Malta and Austria. So the rest of the EU member states clubbed up, and arms have already reached Ukraine now under this program. There's anti-tank systems that have come from the Netherlands. You mentioned fighter jets. That is a separate agreement that's bilateral between, I believe, the countries of Bulgaria and Poland. Bulgaria and Poland happen to have the kind of fighter jets that Ukrainian pilots know how to fly, MiGs. So they are just on their own bat, those two governments supposed to be lending them, making them available. But that's not actually under the joint EU fund. It's actually a separate thing.
Okay. So Naomi, hang on here for just a second, because I want to turn back to Olga in Western Ukraine. Olga, at the very top of the show, we also heard what President Zelensky said just this morning about calling for the EU to essentially fast-track Ukrainian accession to the union. Olga, can you tell me why do you think it was important, or Zelensky felt it was important, to make that direct appeal today?
Well, you know, the EU and NATO membership have been for a long time major Ukrainian foreign policy goals. And now is the moment to, you know, raise these issues again as the world stands in solidarity in Ukraine, but also as finally starting to understand why Ukraine, you know, was pressuring and was insisting that it needs to join these alliances. This is a moment to put that back on the table. You know, the war is still going on, but we already have to think about the future and how Ukraine will, you know, come out of this war. Well, actually, here in Ukraine, I would say that we are sure that Ukraine will win. The problem is that we don't know what the human cost of it will be, because it is clear that Russia is willing to impose, you know, like huge losses and attacking residential areas and stuff like that, and going, I don't know, like hopefully, they will not do what they did in Syria and in other places, but they are showing that they are prepared for that. So, but despite that, you know, Ukrainians keep their spirits up, and we are absolutely sure now that there could be no further obstacles and delays to Ukraine's accession into the EU. And, well, I would say, like, personally, also in NATO, this should be on the table. Ukraine has demonstrated that it is a part of the West. There could be no doubts about that. Everything told by Russia before, it is abundantly clear that it is not true. Ukraine doesn't want to be part of Russian sphere of influence, and especially after this war, you know, this argument is just completely discredited. Mm. So that would be also kind of something that Ukrainians really deserve.
Yeah. Well, Olga Tokariuk, a freelance correspondent and a fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis, with us from Western Ukraine. Olga, my deepest thanks to you, and please do stay safe.
Thank you.
Naomi O'Leary in Brussels. There's just so much to dig into here, but let's just touch up upon something that Olga just said. How is the European Commission responding? Have we heard anything over the course of the past few hours regarding President Zelensky once again directly saying now's the time to fast-track accession?
So when it would have been really useful for the EU to have done something about moving towards Ukraine's accession to the bloc would have been before the invasion. The situation is that the Ukrainian government is operating from basements under bombardments. Accession to the European Union is a technical, long process that with many steps, it's not something that can really go on during the war situation, during an invasion. What the declarations that we are hearing now with Ursula von der Leyen suggesting that the Ukraine belongs in the EU and other comments like that, what those are statements of political solidarity. They're political statements. It doesn't mean, like in technical terms, it doesn't mean much in terms of an official accession. That's really something for the future. It was something that would take a very long time. Certainly this war, at least as so far as it's gone, will have helped public opinion, I think, in terms of helping Western European public opinion to maybe warm again to the idea of admitting more member states. Because in recent years, the whole concept of expanding the EU had become controversial because there had been difficult issues with the integration of existing states.
Good, excellent point here. I mean, I'm seeing here that European Council President Charles Michel on Monday, today, said that even now there are different opinions amongst member countries on any kind of fast track option as and when it could even happen for Ukraine.
That's right. In the past, we had, you know, countries that joined, then there were problems. There was problems to do with economic integration. There's also, you know, very profound political disagreements sometimes, accusations that not enough was done in terms of cleaning up corruption, things like that. And some Western member states, you know, openly thought, well, we should never have expanded. We should have kept the EU smaller because now we're too big. We can't reach agreement on things. And we've got these troublesome member states to our east. So certainly, I think in the longer term, those concerns aren't likely to go away. But the focus now in the present is about making statements of solidarity. There is, I think, a very genuine, heartfelt, you know, will to express that, you know, that Ukraine is part of Europe, and everybody really feels a sympathy for their situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a few minutes, we'll talk more about Germany in particular and other European but non-EU states and the remarkable actions they've been taking over the past few days. But I want to bring into the conversation now Tom Nichols. He's national security scholar at the U.S. Naval War College, contributing writer to The Atlantic, author of a number of books, including No Use, Nuclear Weapons, and U.S. National Security and Eve of Destruction, The Coming Age of Preventative War, and also The Death of Expertise. Tom, good to have you back on the show.
Good to be with you, Meghna.
So there's a lot that I want to dig into with Tom, but first of all, give us your take on what we've been seeing regarding European and specifically EU actions. Is this a more sort of gelled and cohesive European Union than you've seen before?
Well, we have seen it before, but not in over 40 years. Putin has made the classic mistake that his Soviet predecessors made, which was over the years, he's had a Europe that's been somewhat, I won't say divided, but disagrees about how to deal with Russia, mostly interested in just doing business, leaving aside the old grudges and conflicts. And through his own stupidity, I mean, he's not a stupid human being, but this is really stupid strategy. Through his own strategic errors, he has united Europe against him. Again, this happened in the late 70s when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, led to the confrontations of the 1980s. It's really remarkable. So, yeah, this is, I mean, there some pundit got off a great tweet over the weekend that said Putin had ended Swedish neutrality and German pacifism all in one weekend. Which is, you know, kind of really a remarkable thing to say. And when you have even the Swiss talking about joining, you know, sanctions regimes and things like that, I mean, there has to be some sense in Moscow that, you know, 30 years of Soviet and then Russian diplomacy has now just collapsed in a big heap simply because Putin got this, you know, crazy idea that he was going to recreate the Soviet space.
Yeah. So I want us to try to accomplish two things today, right? To continue to look at what might emerge for Ukraine and the EU more broadly on the other side of whatever this military invasion might bring. But also there's the immediate concern. And Tom, I really wanted to talk to you about Putin's nuclear talk over the past couple of days. I mean, how seriously should we take this?
Well, you always have to take it seriously when the leader of a nuclear armed country puts his forces on alert and, you know, starts blustering and talking about aggressive statements that he won't accept and so on. On the other hand, this is part of Putin's playbook. He leans heavily on Russia's nuclear status because, you know, nuclear weapons are the one thing that really allow Russia, nukes on energy, really the things that allow Russia to punch above its weight now in international affairs. So, you know, I don't think people should be panicked about this. It was a move I had expected, and I think the Biden administration has responded exactly the right way by basically ignoring it.
Well, Naomi O'Leary in Brussels, let me turn back to you here because we also have Belarus having voted in the past couple of days to end its non-nuclear status. So that would open the door to Russia putting nuclear weapons in Belarus. I mean, how much of that or how seriously is the EU taking that?
Well, just to say, when you say voted, I mean, Belarus is under a regime which rigs votes. Its current president, Alexander Lukashenko, is considered illegitimate widely by the international community. He's been accused of rigging his own election and crushing a massive opposition movement with extraordinary brutality. So, you know, we should take this referendum with a pinch of salt. Here in the EU, Eastern states have begun to say that, you know, Belarus is de facto occupied by Russia now. It's a puppet state. They've put a military there. They're also, we believe, trying to use Belarusian military to join their invasion. But and certainly what you're seeing then is a response is increased sanctions on Belarus. There already are some, but also, you know, sanctions now targeting the Lukashenko regime because of this cooperation with the invasion, allowing his country to be used as a jumping off point for the war of aggression against Ukraine. In terms of the move on nuclear and what it means, the ending of the neutral status and allowing it to be used for nuclear weapons is, of course, you know, it's concerning from what I'm hearing from EU officials. They're saying, yes, you know, bringing nuclear into the conversation isn't something that we want to hear. However, it's not going to change our actions. We're going to do what we have to. And that's the response that I'm hearing anyway.
Okay. Well, let me just hear. Let's play very quickly. The German Chancellor Olaf Scholz announcing yesterday that Germany will commit 100 billion euros to boosting German armed services. And he announced Germany would also send 1,000 anti-tank weapons and 500 Stinger missiles to Ukraine.
We have experienced a break in everything we have known until now, and that means that the world before this attack is not the same as the world before it. Essentially, it's about the question of whether might can break laws, whether we can allow Putin to turn back the clock to the time of imperial powers of the 19th century, or whether we can draw a line in the sand and contain this.
It's the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz yesterday. Tom, we've got 30 seconds before our next break here. Talk to me about the moves Germany has made and what you make of them.
This is a big deal. You know, not just Germany deciding to aid Ukraine, but to go beyond the 2% limit that we used to have to, you know, kind of cajole them to get to in terms of defense spending. And I think this is one more piece of evidence that whatever this period was of 30 years that we call the post-Cold War era, that's over. And we're now, I think Scholz said it himself, and I think others have noted it, we're in a new era now.
Tom Nichols and Naomi O'Leary, stand by for a moment. We'll be right back with a lot more. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about the latest of what's happening today in Ukraine, and also how Ukrainian resistance to the Russian invasion and attack on Ukraine has transformed the European Union in a mere matter of days. And I'm joined today by Tom Nichols. He's national security scholar at the U.S. Naval War College. And Naomi O'Leary joins us as well. She's in Brussels. She's Europe correspondent for the Irish Times. Naomi, two quick questions for you. First of all, pick up on what Tom was saying about Germany deciding to significantly increase its own defense spending in addition to sending aid to Ukraine. I mean, this has been a very touchy issue in Germany specifically, and also Europe more broadly, because, of course, the long shadow cast by German aggression in two world wars in the 20th century. So how much of a momentous decision is this on the part of the Germans?
I think it's extremely significant. It's one that, you know, was always a difficult issue domestically. The defense ministry in Germany has, you know, long sort of been plagued by problems, by sort of inefficient use of funds, things like that, mismanagement, sort of a problem ministry. Of course, there'd been pressure for many years, including particularly by the US, for Germany to increase its defence spending and reach the 2% NATO target. And it lagged and lagged on that, you know, always struggling with quite a lot of public indifference about the entire issue of defence. And I suppose an assumption, you know, that those days had gone, we were at the end of history, we didn't need defence as much. And there were other priorities for tax money to be spent on. That has just radically changed in the last 5 days. That whole assumption has been thrown out with this enormous announcement of military expenditure. And that's really shifted matters within the EU as well, because, of course, Germany is a very important country in the EU. France had long been calling for more EU cooperation on defence. And now, you know, they've got a lot, now they've got the help from Germany too. So it's really sort of causing a rapid shift in EU positions. And it's, you know, it's reflected by public opinion. I think that's what's really crucial to say. Over the weekend, we had tens of thousands of people out on the capitals, the streets of the capital cities, filled, you know, the boulevards with blue and yellow flags. There's just been an outpouring of horror and outrage at this invasion, real anger towards Russia, and demands for national leaders to do more. Yes. It's been an extreme wake-up call.
So, you know, it's clear that wake-up call, as you put it, Naomi, and this sort of consolidation, profound consolidation of public opinion in Europe in support of Ukraine. We've also talked about these remarkable changes regarding Europe and its attitude towards defense, et cetera. We have seen the financial decisions taken by both the U.S. and the European Union over the weekend. But we also have a profound or an important reality of how connected Europe is to Russia on energy, for example. I mean, so all these actions can be taken today, right now, but what about the things that really still keep Europe rather tied to Russia? I mean, Germany is an interesting example, right? It's Russia's biggest gas customer. Now, Germany may want that to change, but they haven't turned off the gas just yet from Russia. So how important is that in terms of, you know, the long-term changes we're talking about now, Naomi?
Oh, I mean, it's the elephant in the room. It's the events of the last week have just really shown up, you know, decades of particularly German policy towards Russia, where the push was always to increase trade ties. There was a belief that by increasing an economic prosperity, by fostering trade links, that would in itself cause Russia to become a more sort of democratic society, that it would tame Putin. All of those assumptions have gone out the window. Then what happened during those years is that Germany actually became more and more reliant on Russian gas. Now Russian gas powers the backbone of the German manufacturing industry, which is, you know, the backbone of its economy. It's also hugely important for other countries too, the Netherlands, Italy. So, you know, interfering with that supply of gas would be extremely serious. It would mean shortages. This is how people heat their homes. It's how they cook. It's how factories make things. So it's a big problem. Now, the European Union saw this coming. So since those troops started building up on the border of Ukraine, what they've been doing is they've been hustling globally for alternative supply, including from the United States, liquefied natural gas coming across in huge tankers, talks with Nigeria, Qatar, Egypt, all of these unorthodox producers, suppliers of gas, Japan, South Korea. And the aim of the game is to refill those refineries, those gas storage facilities, which are now very low. The German gas, state gas company, has actually, Gazprom, in the months building up to this crisis, actually depleted storage in Europe in actions that now sort of seem to foretell these events. And this had already helped to cause a real problem of high prices that were already really punishing households. So, you know, the effect now of this war is probably going to make that worse. You're going to have, you know, real problems in households with bills. But the difference is now, I think the public have accepted that there's going to be a cost to this war. And it wasn't one that the EU chose. It's one chosen by Russia.
Well, Naomi O'Leary in Brussels, Europe correspondent for The Irish Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tom, I mean, Naomi called it the elephant in the room. And I think that that's a good way of putting it, because Germany, what, 50% of its natural gas comes from Russia. A third of Europe's overall natural gas comes from Russia. Germany may have decided to stop the certification of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. But the long term truth is that European, you know, euros are essentially going to Moscow to fund what the German chancellor is calling Putin's war.
But again, this shows you what a strange world, a strange bubble Putin lives in. I mean, first, you have two countries that are Russia and Ukraine that are at war that are somehow still managing to cooperate to get energy through those countries. You know, we've just that's really the definition of a 21st century war. But it also shows you that, you know, Putin stayed on the course that Russia's been on for 20 years. Europe was becoming more dependent on Russia. And the last thing that any Russian leader should have wanted to do was to kind of wake everybody up about how dangerous that is. Now, the Americans have been trying, you know, on and off for years to warn, I mean, since you know, the 80s, to kind of warn the Europeans about this. You know, there have been endless symposia about, you know, hand-wringing about, is this a good idea? But in the end, the Europeans just kept doing it. And the person who has done more to talk Europe out of that position, that has done more to talk the Europeans out of that than anybody is Vladimir Putin.
Mm. Yeah. No, point well taken. Point well taken. On the other hand, I also see how, you know, people might be looking at 100 years of U.S. policy to Saudi Arabia, for example, and seeing the same sort of head-scratching complications there. But Tom, hang on here. Go ahead.
But we also didn't fight two world wars with Saudi Arabia and live next door to them. And, you know, I mean, in the international community, we all do business with unsavory characters. But for Putin, literally to unravel what should have been a kind of triumph of post-Soviet Russian foreign policy is really just a kind of, you know, startling incompetence. But it also should be a warning about how committed he is to this kind of crazy idea of reconstituting an empire in the middle of Europe.
Yeah. So we've talked about the military question, at least for the moment. We've talked about energy. I also want to talk about the fact that information warfare is clearly a major part of what's going on here. For example, on Saturday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky actually posted a video online addressing what he himself called the fake information online out there. So in this video, Zelensky is actually out on the street and he says there's a lot of fake information online saying that I call on our army to lay down arms and to evacuate. He says, listen, I'm here. We won't lay down our arms. We will defend our state because our weapon is truth. And the truth is, this is our country, our land, our children, and we will defend all of that. Well, Nina Jankowicz joins us now. She's a disinformation fellow at the Wilson Center, the nonpartisan think tank, and also author of How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. Nina, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
How do you view digital information or the role that it's playing in what we've been seeing in the past 5 days?
Well, I think since 2014, really, Ukraine has showed that it is the first truly digital war, and that has certainly ramped up over the past several weeks and months, and then clearly over the past couple of days. What we saw in the lead up to Russia's invasion, reinvasion, we should say, because of course Russia invaded first in 2014, is that the Russian government and its proxies in eastern Ukraine were using staged videos and other types of disinformation in order to create a pretext for war. And now the continued building of that pretext and the continued narrative that Ukrainians are allegedly committing genocide against the Russian people, that the Ukrainian government is fascist, that it's NATO that wants this war to go on, all of that is continuing in a drumbeat from the Kremlin as they drop, as I just watched before this interview began, cluster munitions on cities like Kharkiv. They're the ones that are committing war crimes, likely, and crimes against civilians when they are supposed to be under a special military operation, and they're keeping their citizens from knowing the truth. But happily, because the Ukrainian government has been quite active in pushing back against this disinformation, as you noted, and also the United States and the United Kingdom, along with European allies, have started to pre-bunk this disinformation, I think a lot of people are quite savvy to the idea that this is happening. And there are some people who are going to buy into it, but others are much, much more prepared to dispense with these narratives than we were in 2014. And I think that's heartening. And we're not quite losing the information war anymore. We are starting to learn how to compete in it.
Okay, can you just take a second, though, Nina, to say more specifically about sort of the preemptive pushback on disinformation that the EU and the US knew was coming?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think since 2014, the intelligence capabilities in monitoring the open source space as well as covert space have really grown. And the EU, the UK, and the US have worked together to share that intelligence and declassify some of it. So in 2014, where we didn't know what sources to trust, where the media were very unsure whom to speak to or what narratives would be coming down the pike when this unprecedented annexation of Crimea happened and then the invasion of the Donbass. Here we saw weeks before the invasion even began in Ukraine, while Russia was still massing its forces on Ukraine's borders, we saw press briefings by Jen Psaki and our national security advisor, Jake Sullivan. We saw the British really getting in front of these areas as well, saying false flag attacks might be coming. Here's what we expect the Russian plan to look like in Ukraine. Here are the things to watch out for, the narratives to look out for, and debunking those narratives as well. And all of those things, even though there was a lot of skepticism about that intelligence, given, you know, Western record on declassified intelligence, all of them have come to pass, which is sobering, of course, and saddening, but I think also shows how, again, the West has become savvier when dealing with disinformation, and the fact that Putin has just really leaned into this overt lying means that he doesn't have the purchase that he used to in the online information community.
Nina, just to take a couple quick seconds here, I've seen a lot of people online saying they're seeking information about what's happening in Ukraine that they can trust. What advice would you give people on how to find that trustworthy information?
Well, I think the most important thing is to wait before you amplify anything. Even the most trustworthy sources of information right now are going to be clouded by the fog of war. Just yesterday, the mayor of Kyiv misspoke in an interview to the AP saying that Kyiv was encircled. Seconds later, he retracted that, but that claim then went quite viral online. So just remember, the situation on the ground is changing rapidly, first of all. Secondly, if you are looking at video or images, try to wait until they're verified by open source investigators. Two really good resources are the Center for Information Resilience and Bellingcat. They are working to geolocate and verify information coming out of Ukraine. So just look at those Twitter accounts and make sure that the videos you're sharing are indeed from recent times in this conflict. As Olga said at the beginning of the interview, we've seen things reshared from Syria, from earlier in the Ukraine conflict. So all really important to make sure. And look at trusted sources with people on the ground. Look at Ukrainian sources, Ukrainian reporters who are there living this, and frankly, the foreign correspondents who have boots on the ground as well. There are plenty of people, myself included, frankly, talking about this conflict from the United States, and I am trying to share as much as possible verified information from people who have seen it with their own eyes.
Well, Nina Jankowicz, author of How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today, Nina.
My pleasure.
Tom Nichols, we've got about a minute left here, and we're talking about, you know, a very 21st century moment here. It strikes me, though, that Vladimir Putin is a man of the 20th century as well. I just wonder, what are the kinds of things that you are going to be looking at, Tom, in the next 48 hours, let's say, to help you understand what direction what's happening in Ukraine might take?
Yeah, that's a good observation that Putin is somebody from the 21st century, really. I mean, history for him stops somewhere around 1985. the 21st century certainly didn't happen. There are two things. First, I just want to emphasize something Nina just brought up about being careful about information. This is going to sound odd, but, you know, the average consumer of news, you don't need to know exactly in, you know, you're not in the Situation Room, you're not in the Pentagon, you're not at, you know, Downing Street. You can wait before, you know, wait until a little time passes to start digesting that news. I think people wanting to know things instantaneously is opening opportunities for the Russians to feed kind of toxic material into the mainstream. What I'll be looking for,
you got 5 seconds, Tom.
is whether or not Putin renews the offensive, because this whole thing has gone bad. He expected it to end in 4 days, and now I want to see if he takes a pause or if he starts it up again.
Tom Nichols at the U.S. Naval War College, thank you so much. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.